It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the German-owned grocery store Aldi, known for its cheaper house brand products, is climbing the ranks to be one of the largest grocery store chains in the U.S. A retail expert tells us how the store is shaking up the industry. First, hard work has been a central part of American life for a long time, but for some people, their jobs are about more than a paycheck. They're a big part of their identity and purpose. Our next guest says that the workplace has started to become the go-to place for personal fulfillment, especially for the educated and upper class, and he says that's probably going to leave a lot of us pretty unhappy. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, focused on economics, labor markets, and the media. His recent piece is headlined, "Workism is Making Americans Miserable." Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, what do you mean by workism?
By workism, I mean a concept by which many, many people, in particular, it's important to say, the educated and the well-off, have come to see work and their jobs as the defining part of their identity, that they have essentially turned work into a means of economic production, into a means of identity production. And they, I think, increasingly turn to work for a lot of the things that we've historically associated with traditional religions. We expect purpose and community and transcendence and self-actualization from our jobs. And this isn't just something that a handful of elites believe in. I think it's also something that we tell young people to expect, that at college graduation speeches, we say, you know, hustle for your passion. If you love what you do, you won't have to work a day in your life. So don't stop until you find a job that you absolutely adore. And you see increasingly that teenagers believe the rhetoric. In fact, a recent Pew study found that young people, when asked what they want from their adulthoods, are likely to put a meaningful job over being helpful to other individuals or even having a family. So I think that this idea, which I believe was at least more recently engendered among the rich, has grown to become an American secular religion, that work should be the defining part of our identity. And as I say in the piece, and as you alluded to, I think there are some major problems with this.
Yeah, where do you see problems, especially, you know, not just the people at the upper end of the spectrum, the people who have been most successful in work terms, but those aspiring people lower down the ladder, earlier in their career, where do you see this going wrong?
Yeah. There's a lot of places where I see it gone wrong, but maybe the best way to answer this question is to say, imagine if we worshipped a lottery. Imagine if Americans were told that their God should be a lottery. So every year we would all worship the lottery, and then a handful of people would win. Let's say 5% of people would win the lottery in some way, and the other 95% would lose. But then the very next year, we would turn around and we would tell everybody to worship the lottery again, understanding that there'd be a handful of winners and many, many people who come away disappointed. Well, I think that's exactly how too many of us treat the labor force, that we tell all of these 18-year-olds and 22-year-old college graduates, don't stop until you find the job that you love to death. Don't stop hustling until you find something that makes you happy every single second of the day. And I have nothing against finding a little bit of meaning in work, finding purpose in work, being happy at work. Certainly I'm not against being happy at work. But when we lard work with all of these quasi-religious expectations, we are setting people up for disappointment because the vast majority of jobs, 95% of them, let's say, are not designed to shoulder this burden. The most common jobs in the U.S. economy are cashiers, retail salespeople, food and beverage clerks. Even the most common white-collar jobs aren't particularly fun all the time. They're work in the full sense of the word. And so I think essentially that when we say to ourselves or to our children or to other people's children that work should be pleasure, work should be purpose and transcendence and everything about your happiness as an individual should flow through work, we're asking for better bread than can be made of wheat. And I think it's time for us to have, you know, not to over-employ the religious terminology here, but a little bit of an awakening to recognize that, yeah, it's great to be happy at work, but we can't allow ourselves to be defined by something that's essentially, in terms of jobs, a means to sell stuff to people and make the owners of capital money. Our jobs simply were not designed to bear this burden.
Talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about his recent piece, Workism is Making Americans Miserable. Derek, you write that there's some irony here that not that long ago, a lot of thinkers were saying, okay, we're automating a lot of our jobs. We're going to have more leisure time. We're going to be more and more defined by what we do with that leisure time, our hobbies, our pursuits, our volunteering, things like that. That's going to be our identity, not the workplace. For many people, though, it's moved in the opposite direction.
Yeah, no, there's terrific irony in the fact that we worship work when 90 years ago all of the economists were saying that by now we'd worship leisure. But let's roll back the clock a little bit further. Since Martin Luther, you've had people, particularly in certain faiths like the Protestant faith, actively encouraging followers to treat their work as a religious vocation. To prove, for example, in the Protestant faith, adoration of God by working hard, or even in the Calvinist faith, to prove that you were chosen by God, that you had received his providence by having wealth, by making a lot of money, and having people see that you were among the chosen. So for this idea of freighting work with religious significance was not invented in the 1980s. It was invented hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But I do think that something rather interesting has happened in the last few decades. And that's that in a period of declining traditional religiosity, the number of people who self-identify as Catholic or Protestant is not as high as it used to be, or even Reformed Jewish. But in this period of declining traditional religiosity, there has been an explosion of new atheisms. Now, some people worship beauty, some people worship fitness, some worship their political identity, some certainly worship their children, but I think everybody has to worship something. If you put nothing on the altar, then you're a nihilist, and to be a nihilist is actually to worship something as well. So I think that everybody worships something. The question is just, what do you worship? And the answer for a lot of elite, college-educated, and often somewhat secular Americans in the last, say, 30 to 40 years has, I think, increasingly been work. So some people who read that or hear me say that say, okay, so what? This is just, you know, 5%, 10% of the economy. Who cares if a bunch of rich people are making themselves miserable by sort of expecting too much from their jobs? Well, the problem is that these people tend to be in charge of the laws. And look at what's happened to the laws of this country regarding work in the last 30 years. Increasingly, the welfare state in the U.S. is tied to work. You know, most advanced countries give parents paid leave. We do not. Most advanced countries ease the burden of parenthood with national policies, whereas U.S. public spending on child care and early education is near the bottom of international rankings. You know, in a lot of countries, there's universal health care. But in the U.S., the majority of prime-age Americans get their health care through, where else, their workplace. So I think that it's not just an elite issue. Workism is not just an elite problem. It's not just a cult of the elite. It's the law for everyone. It's a piece of public policy. And so to criticize workism is to criticize not only private feelings, but also the evolution of public policy itself.
We're talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic. He says, Americans, many of us are developing an almost religious obsession with work. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you get most of your purpose or satisfaction from your work life compared to the rest of your life? Are you seeking that job that has meaning? Is that where you're hoping to end up someday? Do you think we put too much emphasis on jobs as part of our identity? And do we work too much? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, about his recent piece, Workism is Making Americans Miserable. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we define ourselves too much by the job we do? If you think that's a problem, what's the solution? Is your job a big part of your identity, your purpose? Do you think that it's realistic to hope that all of us can find a job that gives us that kind of meaning? If our meaning doesn't come from a job, where does it come from? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls. Will is with us in Platteville. Will, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had two questions, or maybe one's a comment. Traditionally in Western culture, we've often identified ourselves by our jobs. Many surnames are based off of occupations. And it seems to be a very, especially English thing to do that. But I was also curious, the commenter mentioned Protestantism, which makes me think of Max Weber. I was curious if he could comment on Marx's idea of alienation, that we get a sense of purpose from our work, and doing so provides fulfillment.
Will, thanks for the call. Yeah, we have a lot of Smiths and Weavers and Taylors and other work-based names in various languages, Derek. But getting back to the philosophy idea, is it better? Can we have the aspiration to not be alienated from our work? Can that job you were mentioning of the cashier be made to be more fulfilling somehow?
Right. I think there's a lot in that question. I love the question. Max Weber is famous for in the 1920s and 1930s writing about the Protestant work ethic and essentially arguing that Protestantism helped to invent capitalism because it encouraged people to work really, really hard and then also encouraged them to be frugal. So they save a lot of money. That money goes into finance and the financial investments create capitalism. It's a tidy theory. And I also think that it goes to show that a lot of what I'm talking about has existed for a while in different phases under sort of different names. That said, I do think that to the extent that what I describe as workism was born in the Protestant faith, I think it's been exported to the secular world where it's been sort of supercharged, that a lot of people who think of themselves as not religious, even a-religious or anti-theistic, against the idea of a God, have nonetheless poured their identities into their work in a way that I do think is different from, you know, the world that gave us the Smiths and the Weavers that you're describing. These are people who are rich. They can do whatever they want. And historically, in economic history, the rich don't work a lot, right? The landed gentry and the aristocrats of Europe are famous for playing games and gossiping all the livelong day, not for toiling as blacksmiths. So what's fascinating to me is that in the one of the richest countries in the world, and certainly among the richest countries in the history of the world, many of the richest have chosen to do what with their extraordinary wealth? They've chosen to buy more hours of work. That's not an extension of economic history. That's a break from economic history. And it therefore, I think, requires a new theory to explain it. And that's what I'm trying to do here. That is why I think workism is not merely an extenuation of the trends that were described in the phone call, but a different break altogether.
Will, thanks for the call. We're going out to Brad with us in Kellner. Brad, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up, Brad?
Johnny Carson once said that in America, a man is his job. So this is nothing new, I don't think, at least not for men. Society, and I suppose especially women, still judge men mostly on their career prestige and income. That's why it's so devastating for a man to lose his job or if they become disabled or sick and can no longer work.
Brad, thanks for the call. Again, Derek, you see something different. Not that we've never identified with our jobs, but we're throwing ourselves into it, identity, in ways that maybe we haven't in the past.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's a good summary. It is true. Let me pick up on the second thing that was said. Mm-hmm. It's true, of course, that a life without work mm-hmm. is extremely problematic, socially, economically, spiritually. And in no part of the essay or in no part of my argument am I suggesting that we don't have to work. I mean, there is work to be done, and I think that work has many good things about it. there's actually some research that seems to suggest that, that being attached to the labor force in some way is important enough in the modern economy, that, and important enough to the modern culture, that those men who lose their jobs and are on long-term unemployment, they tend to be depressed for even a longer and deeper period of time than those who lose loved ones. And that research finding might initially seem really strange, you know, the idea that, that losing a job would be worse than, you know, losing a parent or a partner. But one explanation for it is that one of the ways that we get beyond grief is by immersing ourselves in an immersive habit. And work often provides that immersion. And so without anything to immerse ourselves in, then we truly do feel lost. But I think it's worth thinking through a bigger question, which is, in a world that's coming where productivity increases, where automation and AI is doing more stuff than it used to, and that the total amount of labor required to make the world work continues to decrease, we might have the opportunity to have more leisure. And we might indeed define ourselves by not what we do at work, but by, you know, the communities that we're involved in, by our families, by our activities outside of the workplace in, say, third spaces. And I think that it's going to be really interesting to see how this generation that is really aggressive at defining itself by work finds new ways of defining ourselves if indeed we are moving into a world without work or a world with significantly less work.
Brad, thanks for that call. We're talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about our relationship with work in the modern era. Back to your calls. Mark is with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for the topic. What if the problem that we experience is that we're actually psychologically deluding ourselves that we like work simply because there's no way to get out of it because the system that we use for money is a system where everything, everybody, rich and poor, is using debt for money. So you cannot have money unless you have debt. And it doesn't much matter. The mathematical certainty is that the chances of losing everything are greater no matter how far up the ladder you are.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So, Derek, in effect, we got to work, so are we just making a virtue out of necessity?
Yeah, no. Now, there's a question that I really like. I think to frame it a little bit, I'd say work is three things. It's labor. It's the hard work of actually sewing or constructing or writing code. That's number one. Number two, it's money. And number three, it's purpose. And I think it's really interesting to think, well, what happens as more labor goes to technology? What happens as more labor is done by automation, by robots, by AI? Where does the money and the purpose go? This is a huge, huge, fascinating philosophical question. On the money point, I think I would say that right now it's absolutely the case that almost every part of the welfare system has to move through work in the U.S. economy, or we've decided that it has to move through work. You know, if most welfare, like the biggest welfare program right now is arguably the earned income tax credit. In order to get that, you have to be working. If you want to have health care, you almost certainly have to be working if you're a prime age worker. But there are ways to build universal policies that guarantee certain rights to citizens that don't need to have essentially a work guarantee. You could say everybody in the U.S. is guaranteed health care. You could say everyone in the U.S. is guaranteed a certain income, a kind of universal basic income or a negative income tax, which is actually popular among conservative economists going back to the 1970s. And I think I'd like some of the policy entrepreneurship to go to is to begin to think through ways that as we need fewer hours of work to make the world work, what do we do with the money that we have? How do we find ways to redistribute it to keep society working? And I think that the answer there is going to be to find more policies that pursue this kind of universalism.
Thanks for that call. Derek, one more point I wanted to get into. You mentioned that millennials are being raised as, I think the phrase, machines of self-optimization through school. If you look online, there's always tips on how to be more productive. Why are you wasting your time instead of hustling? That kind of thing. And there's a lot of anxiety that comes with that. Can you talk about this huge thing in pop culture and online culture and beyond?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's no question that millennials are prime candidates for the workist generation. I think this is a generation that went to college more than any other generation before it. And a lot of the evidence from research on colleges seems to find that if you go to especially an elite college, one of the most important things that you get out of it is an interest in working more hours. It doesn't necessarily make you more productive on an hourly basis, but it makes you more of a careerist. So in many ways, we've essentially minted a generation of young people who are exceptional careerists. And I think that a lot of the anxieties that you see among millennials is this gap between the expectation that an attitude of careerism would make them rich and the reality that it has not done so. I also think it's really important to talk about the factor of social media. I think a lot of people who are workists, who do take enormous pride and enormous identity from what they do all day, those who tend to be the happiest workers tend to be sort of intrinsically in love with their work. They simply love the minutes and the hours of what they do, and they don't need status or money necessarily to come with it. It's the joy of the doing that matters most. But I think it's harder now to sort of keep to hold on to sort of or protect the preciousness of intrinsic motivation in a world of social media where all communication is essentially a competition. You know, you go onto Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn or Instagram, and all you're exposed to are people in your local network who are most celebrated for what they've just done. These algorithms are consistently sorting for whoever just got the most likes. And it creates this feeling, I think, where like our lives don't exist until we get that feedback loop from social media. That you will go on vacation, for example, and we'll have to post our vacation photos to Instagram, and only the photo that gets the most likes will retroactively say was our favorite memory. I think this is like a really sick way and unfortunate way, frankly, to think about happiness. Is to think that happiness is whatever the crowd says I should be happiest about. I think this is another element of the workist recipe that is making us disillusioned and depressed.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Derek Thompson for joining us, staff writer at The Atlantic. He joined us to talk about his recent piece. You can read more of what he has to say in The Atlantic. The piece is called Workism is Making Americans Miserable. Coming up after the news, the grocery chain Aldi is rising up the ranks of grocery stores. We'll find out how the German-owned chain is finding success in the U.S. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, communities around the state saw major flooding over the weekend. We'll get the latest news on conditions in the affected areas from Wisconsin Emergency Management. First, the American grocery industry is seeing fast-growing competition from a German-owned retailer. Aldi has been moving up in the ranks of top grocers for the past decade, and they have plans to add 900 more stores in the U.S. by 2022. That would make them the third largest grocer in the country by number of stores. They've also been busy remodeling current stores and expanding their fresh produce sections. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you checked out Aldi? Are you a regular shopper? If so, what keeps you coming back? And in general, what do you look for in a grocery store? Is it a wide selection? Is it price, quality, service, or whatever's closest to your house? Are there other grocery stores that stand out to you as doing something different? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Hart Posen is an associate professor of management at the UW School of Business. Hart, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. How does a store like Aldi, growing fast here, how do they distinguish themselves from the rest of the retail grocery pack?
You know, I think that is the unique thing. They are clearly distinguished from the rest of the pack, right? You walk into an Aldi, you know you're not in a Walmart. You know you're not in a Kroger Pick and Save. You know you're not in a Trader Joe's or a Whole Foods. They are really differentiated.
And how so? What does that look like?
Well, you know, they are really competing at the lower end of the market, right? Their stores are much smaller than traditional grocery stores. They have a much smaller selection. They don't have fancy shelving. Stuff is often displayed in the boxes or on pallets. And a vast majority of their product is their own branded, is private label. So you're not going to see a lot of the traditional brands on their stores.
And that's really different from the big grocery store where you have this bounty, you know, like 80 kinds of ketchup, say, or whatever. This is not that.
This is not that. You know, we've talked a lot about changing retail, you and I, over the last couple of years on this show. And one of my claims there is that many of those firms going out of business, you cannot distinguish them from their rivals. But in this, it, you know, what Aldi is doing is being very clear, very unique. They are not, you know, you asked the question at the outset, what do you, a listener, prefer? But Aldi's point is there are some consumers who are not for us. Those are Costco consumers, let's say. But if you want very low prices, you're willing to sacrifice the name brands for our private label brands, you're willing to do away with any frills, we're for you. And it's really clear.
Now, I was reading about when Aldi came to England, and a lot of the grocery store chains there said, not worried. There's a stigma on discount shopping. People aren't gonna, they don't like generic brands. We are the same things in the United States. Now, Aldi is in the top three in England, as I understand it. They are on course. They just moved up to number 9 in America, according to a chart. So, yeah, I guess the stigma on discount shopping isn't really there like people thought it was.
You know, until fairly recently, and the mainstream grocers, you know, those owned by Kroger's, which here would be Roundy's or Pick and Save, or those owned by Albertsons, which in some ways is like Safeway. There has been remarkably little innovation. And what we're seeing now is a period of tremendous innovation. It really predates Aldi's. It goes back really to the emergence of both Whole Foods at the high end and Trader Joe's, which is, by the way, owned by the same family, although a different company than Aldi's.
South Aldi's as opposed to North Aldi's, I learned today.
Yeah, well, the two Albrecht brothers split up Europe a number of years ago. The North folks are the ones that started, they bought Trader Joe's, then grew it. The Aldi suit came in with Aldi in the U.S. They're both, in some sense, similar but different, right? They're both heavily private label. They're both much smaller stores. They're both much smaller selection. Although clearly on other dimensions, Trader Joe's and Aldi's are quite different.
Talking to Hart Posen from the UW Business School about the rise of Aldi, the German-owned grocery retailer, zooming up the charts in terms of retail sales. Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Port Washington. Karen, hello.
It's actually Carrie, but that's okay.
Carrie, go ahead.
I was actually just on my way home from there. It used to be a place where we knew we had some good stuff and we'd stop for a few select things and then go do our Costco and other shopping. But now it seems like they've really upped their game on their organic products and we really like that. So it's now becoming more of a place where we divide our shopping between Costco and there and the other retailer that we choose.
Karen, thanks a lot for that call. And Hart, I know Aldi has been upgrading some. Is this a thing where they're trying to go from you come here to find, like Karen was saying, those particular cheap things or find that one deal that happens to be there today to being more of a one-stop shop?
You know, I think what you see happening at Aldi is they come in to the U.S. at the very bottom end, only, you know, all private label, very little fresh produce. And what they're trying to do is find that sort of sweet spot. They do not want to be a Pick and Save. But it is to find that sweet spot where they have the right share of fresh, the right share of organic. And that doesn't mean the share that is at Costco, right? Mm-hmm. The last thing they want to become is another Kroger or Pick and Save, right? Because that would defeat the whole purpose of the differentiation.
Thanks for calling on your way home from grocery shopping, Carrie. We'll go now to Jay in Madison. Jay, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us, Jay?
Well, I love shopping at Aldi. First of all, Aldi is close to my house. It's 5 minutes away from where I live. If I were to go to Costco, which I've never been in a Costco in my life, but it's a half-hour drive just for me to get there. So the Aldi's close to where I live. I can go through the five aisles of the store and get all the stuff that I need. I don't need to pick between 27 brands of pinto beans. I mean, I just need some pinto beans sometimes, you know? And I can get in there, and I you know, I don't shop there necessarily for economic reasons, although it is a little cheaper than like Hy-Vee or some of the other stores. But I don't shop there for that reason. I shop there because I can get in, I can get the cart full of stuff that I need, I can get out, I can take my stuff home and have it all done in an hour, and I don't end up with 27 plastic bags that I then have to deal with somehow.
Jay, thanks for the call. A lot to work with there, Hart. One of them is, and I've been reading this, it's a discount store. It is not just targeting lower-income customers. There's a middle-class appeal that they're shooting for here.
No, I think that's absolutely right. It is not aimed at the lower economic spectrum. I think it's aimed at middle-class folks who want a simpler shopping experience, willing to trade off the small store for the selection because, as Jay said, we don't need 27 types of pinto beans, at least most of the time. And there's also fun stuff there. You know, my wife likes the fact that they stock German chocolate and some really good German chocolate that before Aldi you could only get in Germany.
Aha, okay.
So there are little sort of jewels in there.
Thanks for that call, Jay. Time for another caller. Matthew in Pleasant Prairie is with us now. Matthew, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about Matthew?
I'm on my way to Aldi, and I thought I had to call in.
Okay, so why are you on your way to Aldi? Why do you shop there?
All the reasons everybody said. It's small and convenient. You go in there, you get out quick. You're not sorting through anything. The prices are great, and like the last your guest said, you always find something you didn't expect to find there. So yeah, it's a great place to go. You don't always get everything, but what you get, you're happy you got it, and you got it for a good price.
All right, Matthew, thanks for the call. From our callers here, unless Aldi has just like managed to see what we were doing today and planted a bunch of callers, but for our callers, it sounds like, Hart, there's some brand loyalty. Some people enjoy this particular store for a particular reason.
You know, I think there is some growing brand loyalty, but I also think it is because if you want that kind of experience, they're just about the only player, and certainly the only nationwide player that has the scale economies to do it well.
Is this going to change, or is it already changing some of the other bigger, Walmart's is the top grocery, Kroger's up there. There's a lot of stores in regional markets. Is this changing the way they have to do business?
Yeah, this is, well, not only Aldi, but clearly the Amazon Whole Foods thing. It is about time grocery changed from sort of the traditional Kroger model that comes to dominate in the 70s and 80s and 90s. It's about time we saw something new. And to be honest with you, we need more stores. You know, one of the things you and I have talked about on the show previously when we talked about Quick Trip last month was this notion that in many areas we observe sort of grocery stores going away, sometimes being replaced by large convenience stores. Quick Trip is moving into that space. Aldi has a model here that is more cost effective, which might mean that it works in a whole bunch of areas where traditional pick and save / Kroger would not work. So I think there's real promise here for Aldi nationwide.
It's pretty amazing to me. I mean, it's been, 70-some years since we caught on to this idea of, hey, instead of having the cashiers go around and pick out your groceries for you, you walk around the store and shop. But it seems like we would have worked everything out by now. It's pretty amazing to me that there's still this kind of innovation from various companies out there.
You know, I think this is true in lots of contexts. It's easy to believe that we, at any given time, we see the one true best way of doing things. But there are a couple of things. Technologies change, consumers change, and in that process, we discover new ways, right? On your point, you know, when we buy stuff online, you know, Aldi has hooked up with Instacart in the U.S. That is doing exactly the opposite. It's, you know, as a grocery store, a retail store is really a self-serve environment. You go around the shelves, you pick stuff up, you drive there, you take it to the cash register, you pay, then you drive it home. And when we shop online, if it's Instacart partnered with Aldi, that is saying someone else is going to do it. So we're observing this interesting mix.
We'll leave it there, Hart. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Hart Posen, Associate Professor of Management at the UW School of Business. He was with us to talk about the success of the German-owned grocery store Aldi and how it's shaking up the grocery business in the U.S. Coming up, we'll talk to a spokesperson for Wisconsin Emergency Management about major flooding in communities all over the state over the last 4 days. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, stores that don't accept cash say they operate more efficiently and are safer than those that do, but there's been a backlash. Now one major U.S. city is banning cashless retailers. We'll get the details. First, Wisconsin remains under a statewide state of emergency as parts of Wisconsin continue to deal with major flooding. The flooding was triggered by a quick melting of this winter's snowpack, and over the weekend it caused power outages, road closures, and the evacuation of hundreds of people around the state. Lori Getter is a spokesperson for Wisconsin Emergency Management. Lori, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, where do we see some of the worst flooding, Lori?
Well, as of today, we have three hot spots. The first one is the Trempealeau River, the town of Dodge, where there's an ice jam that's caused the evacuation of about 12 homes and businesses over the weekend. We still have an ice jam in the Milwaukee River in Ozaukee County that's also causing some problems. And then the Pecatonica River in Greene County, Martinstown, is continuing to flood as well. The good news is most of the other rivers have been starting to leveling off, starting to drop, which is good news. But again, we still have some flooding going on, pockets here and there.
And this is seems like a unique situation in my memory. Usually if there's flooding, it seems like it's concentrated. It's hitting one place really hard. This, there's spots in so many parts of the state. Does that make it harder to deal with from a statewide emergency management perspective?
It does, because it's really all across southern Wisconsin, and it might be a small neighborhood here or a larger community there that are experiencing flooding. And this is very unique, because if you go back for the last couple of months, well, you actually should go back to last fall, southern Wisconsin was impacted by heavy rains and flooding, so that ground was already saturated. Then we had the polar vortex. We had many communities that had freezing rain, so you know, ice on top of that, as well as heavy snowpack. And then early last week, having the warmer, sudden warm temperatures and rain, it was just, you hate to say the phrase, perfect storm, but it really was to have winter flooding, and that's what we're experiencing.
Now, focusing on the good news, Lori, last I saw, I think no major injuries or deaths reported as of this morning when I saw. Is that still true, I hope?
That's true, and we're very fortunate. And the other good news is we had about 300 people that were evacuated. Most people are back in their homes. I know communities are working very hard with the building inspectors to inspect homes, get power back on so people can get back home. But there's still a lot of cleanup, and we're really thankful for the Red Cross and Salvation Army and other organizations that are in those communities helping those residents with cleanup.
We've been hearing these messages in the news lately, but remind us, give us some of the flood safety 101 tips. What kind of things should be on our mind for this flood, for future floods?
Well, the first one, when you come across a flooded road, turn around, don't drown. That's where we see a lot of fatalities during flooding, is people think they can drive through or walk through, and that water is very misleading. The other thing is people need, now's the time, even though we've had flooding occurring, people still do mitigation efforts around their homes. If you have a window well or an area that always water comes into your home, do some mitigation efforts while you can. Also consider flood insurance. Now's a great time to talk to your insurance agent to make sure you have adequate protection. Most of your insurance policies do not cover flooding or sewer backup, so talk to your insurance agent, weigh those risks. But with this case, many homes were along the rivers or creeks, but some of them were several miles away, so it was just, you know, heavy rainfall or the heavy snow melt, and that caused the flooding. So it's important to weigh your risk and make those conversations and make those decisions now.
Talking to Lori Getter, spokesperson for Wisconsin Emergency Management, about the floods. Some have receded, some, have we heard, still ongoing now around Wisconsin. Lori, are there any road closures still out there?
There's still a lot of road closures. Most of the main ones are open. We still have a few that are closed, but there's still a lot of local roads that are closed, bridges that are closed. And so as we begin to the recovery phase, people are, our county officials, local officials are out evaluating those roads, doing damage assessments, and those numbers will start to come in the next few days.
For people getting ready to go for a drive, maybe in a place that isn't usually on their beaten path, what state resources are out there to make sure that the road they want to take is actually open?
Well, if you want to go to on a major road, go to 511 Wisconsin. They have a website, a great website with the latest road closures. Again, if you come up to a detour sign, you know, don't go past that detour. There's a reason why that sign's up, especially in some of those county roads. It's going to take a while for those roads to be inspected, even the bridges to be inspected as well to make sure that they're safe, because the water came up fast and did cause quite a bit of damage. So, you know, don't take your risk.
We've talked about safety on the roads. How about in homes that have been flooded? What kind of advice do you have for people when there's the flooding? Maybe that pilot light is out in the furnace. All the problems that can ensue right after a home is flooded.
Well, again, utility companies have been out there working hard going into those homes that have been impacted to, again, check those furnaces to start the pilot light. But it's just even the cleanup. It doesn't take long before mold can start to grow, so it needs to be cleaned up quickly. Flooding's horrible to clean up at any time of the year, but especially this time of year because it's cold. Sometimes the furnaces haven't been running, so it's just a miserable situation, and volunteer groups are there ready to provide assistance as well.
And sometimes, sadly, after any kind of natural disaster, there are scams, things like that, people offering to help with repairs, flood remediation, that sort of thing. Do you have thoughts? I know this is a little outside of the emergency management side of things. Any thoughts on making sure you're getting reliable help when you need it?
It's always good to, you know, get a couple bids, a couple estimates, look for reviews, you know, talk to neighbors, see, you know, if they are familiar with that business, you know, check those reviews, and, you know, just be wary of outside contractors.
Now, these kind of disasters, again, no major injuries, no deaths here. In a way, we can look at these as a test of how we do in responding to emergencies. Are there lessons at the local level for, you know, city and county emergency managers that we can take away from this last few days of flooding?
You know, there will be. We'll be doing after-action reporting after, probably a few weeks after this settles down. But to be honest, we're looking at the next possible punch next weekend. Northern Wisconsin still has a lot of snow on the ground. They're anticipating some warm temperatures by the end of the week, temperatures in the upper to mid-50s. We're hopeful that there isn't any additional rain, but that snow is going to come down south. So we're worried about potential flooding in the northern part of the state, but also that water coming down to southern Wisconsin, causing some of those streams and rivers to rise again. So we're very concerned about that for more flooding.
Right. In the current state of affairs, in most cases, as you were saying, the streams and rivers and creeks are not rising anymore. They're receding in many places. That said, by the time that snowmelt comes, they're still going to be pretty high, right?
They're still going to be pretty high. And then if we also should have some heavy spring rains, which we have had in the past, we could be in trouble again. So we're not out of the woods yet, so to speak. We're watching things very closely, and we're hopeful for more of a gradual snowmelt for the next few weeks, especially for northern Wisconsin.
All right, that's flooding. Now, some of my relatives in Michigan have already had to take shelter during tornado warnings. It's that time of year. Lori, any messages you want to have out there when it comes to our tornado preparedness now that we're in mid-March?
It is, and I actually heard a few thunderstorms last week, too, so it's time to be prepared not only for potential winter storms, but also for thunderstorms and potential tornadoes. So, you know, it's always a good idea. Our statewide tornado drill is coming up April 11th. There's great information on readywisconsin.wi.gov about the drill and being ready for all types of emergencies. But it's time to start transitioning from winter to start getting ready for spring and summer storms.
All right, Lori, thanks so much for joining us. I'll let you watch for that next potential series of floods.
Thank you.
That's Lori Getter with Wisconsin Emergency Management. She joined us to talk about major flooding around Wisconsin over the last few days and cleanup efforts as floodwaters start to recede. Now we want to hear from you online. Let us know if you personally or your community has been affected by flooding. You can share pictures with us if you would like. You can reach us in a few different ways. You can email ideas@WPR.org. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or send us a message there, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Has the flooding affected your town? Were you one of the people, fortunately fairly small number of people, who had to evacuate during this? Were you out filling sandbags in your community? I know a lot of towns had mobilized volunteers to do that. Are you involved in your local emergency management as a coordinator, as part of city staff who steps up? Like to hear your stories. Email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. All right, everybody, pencils out. It is time for a spelling test. Here are three words for you. Can you spell these? Lapilli, England, not England, the country, England, and Magellan. What? Those are the three closing words in the Badger State Spelling Bee over the weekend. I only knew one of the three, Magellan, like the explorer guy, exactly like that. I could spell that. Turns out England, and this is E-N-G-L-Y-N, it's a kind of Welsh poem. That's not a word I had encountered before. And lapilli, this was the winning word, by the way. They're bits of rock, it's plural, bits of rock that are shot out of a volcano. I'm paraphrasing the formal definition. We got three top winners in the state. They're going to head over to the Scripps National Spelling Bee in late March. And of course, hearing this probably calls a lot of us, myself included, back to our own spelling bee experiences. I may have told you this story before. I think sixth grade, I'm going to say maybe fourth grade. My dad worked in the town of Taylor, Michigan. T-A-Y-L-O-R, Michigan. So what word knocks me out of a spelling bee? Taylor, like a person who makes clothes. T-A-I-L-O-R. I got it wrong, but I was sure I was right. I'd seen this word again and again. I'd written it out, but yep, nope. It was tailor-made to knock me out of the competition. Dean's liking that one. All right, Dean. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.